Hello and welcome to The New Romantics. I'm Will Eaves and I'm a writer, novelist and poet and occasional performer, and Sophie Scott is
a cognitive neuroscientist. That means that I'm interested in brains and behaviour and how brains relate to behaviour and experience. And what we do in The New Romantics is Will sends me short stories and books and poems to read, and I send him academic papers to read, and I get the better half of this deal, I think. And then we try and make sense of it. We're trying to make sense across the imagined divide between the arts and the sciences, which we generally find is much less there than we think.
Today, we're looking at a paper called Retrieval Pathways for Common and Proper Names, and also a lovely piece by Mark Twain written around about the turn of the 20th century, a little bit after, called The Diaries of Adam and Eve. Actually, it was Eve's diary to begin with, and then excerpts from the supposedly discovered diary by Adam. They're quasi-satirical, very funny. First of all, Sophie's going to tell us something about the paper.
So the paper is, it's in a classic tradition of cognitive neuropsychology, where people work with patients who've had patterns of brain damage that have left them with more selective patterns of deficits. This was before people got really into brain imaging. Cognitive neuropsychology was the way that cognitive scientists would try and relate sort of experience and behaviour to brains by looking for these patterns of where things had gone wrong following, say, stroke or dementia. But the holy grail, as it were, was always to look for a double dissociation. So a patient who had an intact long-term memory but a deficit in their working memory, or vice versa. And here the author is setting out, and he's a classic cognitive neuropsychologist, Carlo Semenya. Italy and the UK were two of the really big places for this pattern of cognitive neuropsychology, and he's one of the bigger figures in it. And what he's looking at is patterns of problems patients have with proper names versus common nouns, nouns for things in your environment. So we name lots of things in our world, we name most of the things we can see in our world, but here he's asking, is there something different about proper names? And proper names are our names, Sophie or Will, or the name of a shop, or the name of a geographical location. So the names that have associated with people or places, as opposed to the name you might, that's a table, that's a chair, that's a rug. Those are proper nouns.
So he's not really distinguishing between proper names and proper nouns, is he?
He's not, no. They use the term interchangeably, actually. Yeah. And he goes through some different cases where patients have had specific problems with proper names or proper nouns. And he finds that there are, as you would expect in cognitive neuropsychology, there are different ways that this can go wrong. So you might have a problem being able to recognise a proper noun, but if you are given cues to the person's identity, being able to recognise them. You might have problems recognising somebody's name when said to you, but also you have difficulty recognising that person even though that person's famous from information about them. So there's semantic damage to that sort of that link. Or you might have problems recognising the person from their face, but if you show them the written name, then people would be able to recognise the person and give you information about them. So there's different routes into the system and different levels at which it can go wrong. The interesting thing from a sort of classic cognitive neuropsychology perspective is he sets out several of these cases, and then each illustrating sort of these slightly different aspects. And then he looks for the double dissociation, and what he finds is you don't get it. So you find patients who have a sparing of their ability to name people and places, but not things. But they're always really odd, and they don't have many things in common. There are examples of people who might be have spared naming of people they know, but not of geographical places.
So just to be clear, what you mean by spared naming is those are the things they can still
they
remember.
They can still do. Yeah. They can still do. You might they can follow a prompt.
In other words, they're spared the decline that's evident elsewhere.
Exactly. And that's interesting because it suggests that there isn't a... We're not looking at two different modules here. If one can be damaged and the other preserved in both directions, that you start to suggest you're looking at two different systems. And that's not what's happening here. it's looking a little bit like if something can be preserved about how you name people and places following brain damage, it's still been compromised. If your ability to name things more generally is compromised, it will take down some of your ability to name people and places as well. It's not spared in the same way. So it does suggest that it might be that there may be more kind of maybe a hierarchy involved. One's a subset of the other. The proper names are a subset of names in the world.
The thing that immediately, you know, strikes me and that I found challenging in a way reading that paper was that you've just alluded to the fact that there seems to be some kind of global impact. If you've got a disease like Alzheimer's or some other neurodegenerative disorder, there's a global impact on the ability to sort of remember both nouns and proper nouns. But what the paper also seems to be saying is that it's definitely the case that it costs more in some way for people to retrieve the proper names and nouns. Yeah. While it may be a subset of a global condition of remembering, it is in practically all cases more difficult for people to retain proper names. And this has, what I didn't really understand, this is partly because the author thinks there might be a separate pathway for retrieval of proper nouns neuroscientifically, neurologically, which we don't know what it is, but it might exist. But also it seems to be something to do with the nature of recognizing that goes on with a proper noun. Mm. And in other words, its capacity to refer intelligibly to something. The problem with proper nouns being that the, and this is only one philosophical view of it, supported by people like Frege in the 19th century, but also much further back to a certain extent of Aristotle and Leibniz as well, that a proper name is arbitrary in some way. Mm. It refers, yes, to a person who I know very, the wonderful, lovely Sophie Scott is in front of me, but you could as well be Susan or Hildegard of Bingen. In fact, I might call you Hildegard from now on.
Quite
so
like
it's
that.
So it's sort of, it's arbitrary.
Yeah.
The difficulty I had is that, is it arbitrary?
Yeah.
Because, of course, proper nouns are very various, and some proper nouns are actually, they designate things that are, they're also common in a sense, because they belong to, something like the Eiffel Tower. Well, that's a proper noun, but it's also part of the class, if you like, of monumental objects that are all quite recognisable as that.
Mm.
So I feel the distinction between the proper and the common, it's not sufficiently made clear, and it's very arguable.
I think the thing that I wish you'd made more of in the paper is that it's almost like the opposite is true. So it's the names that we give things our environment or actions in our environment, you know, like a shoe or a table or a computer screen or a skeleton, things I see around my office. When we learn those words, we don't just store them as words that map onto things in the world. We organise them into a sort of network with a very rough kind of like semantic hierarchy, such that a table has got something in common with a side table or a coffee table, and it's associated with chairs, but chairs have got also, chairs are kind of grouped off with stools and bar stools and bean bags and other things you might sit in. And when you learn a new word, so if I said, oh, would you like a cup of mant, have a lovely cup of mant, if it's something that goes in the cup, okay, well, it's probably already a liquid. And if so, you taste it and it's delicious and it's warm, okay, but it's a kind of hot drink, I'm enjoying my cup of mant. And you're grouping that new word with this new thing, which has semantic properties which let you group it with the other stuff. It's a kind of liquid, it's a kind of liquid that we drink. And that helps you remember it and encode it. You're not just here up to a new word for a new thing. Exactly, and those associations do seem to be stored in some ways, not in all ways, in a way that is relatively abstract. There really is that sort of abstract hierarchy. One of the things that can happen if you have a horrible disease called semantic dementia is it starts picking away at those abstract associations, so you stop being able to group things into their classes from very kind of specific things like glass vessels from which to drink, all the way through to things you might find in a house. It's not the only way we store information about the meanings of things in the world. If a thing has got strong sensory associations, like a glove, you know, you can imagine what a glove looks like and you can imagine a glove being pulled onto your hand. Your brain uses that information to store information about the word glove, which is visual information or auditory information or somatosensory information. It might be emotional information. So it's not that we only store meaning in this abstract way. But what it does mean is that for common nouns, you've got this extra structure that you fit it into. It seems to be almost like a speciality of how humans think. We are very good at this kind of organising stuff into hierarchies and networks and thinking about how they associate together. It helps you remember the name of the thing because you've got a place for everything. Cups have things in common with mugs, and that helps you remember cups and mugs as words and what they refer to. So the arbitrariness of, or the supposed arbitrariness of proper names is arbitrary in the sense that it's not like these things you can form associations of and you have to make the links. So there are lots of things that are still there in proper names. Certainly for people, you've got sex and gender being reflected. Mm. You've got geographical origins and, you know, kind of countries and religions reflected in there as well. But there's still, you know, I don't want to boast, but I know quite a lot of Williams. And, you know, guys, and actually they have some very general stuff in common, but beyond that, I do, you know, I need to do something more to remember that person's, the link between, you know, this is Will Eves, and obviously that's very easy for me because you're so lovely. Probably because I first saw your name written down on books and then I learned the person, I've probably had a slightly different journey with your name. I can remember when I worked in a jewellery shop in the 1980s, I had a boss, the assistant manager was called Chris or Sean, and for the life of me, I couldn't tell you now what his name actually was. All I know is I always called him the wrong name. I think I thought he was called Chris, and he was actually called Sean. And I'd got it fixed. I'd totally gone, I've made this link now, and I couldn't get past it. And he'd spent a lot of time patiently explaining that wasn't his name.
But tricky there, because the mistake is founded on something quite simple, which is that one word ends with an S, and the other begins with an S, and they're both monosyllables. So you actually have a kind of symmetrical pattern there. I don't know, is that homology or something like that? But it's problematic. Once you've made the mistake there, you can see how it would fix. Mm. I mean, the mistake would fix.
Yeah, the mistake
because
does.
Because it has a pattern.
Yeah.
Which actually the words don't have because they're both, you know, supposedly arbitrary. I absolutely take your point about the network of, you know, the almost fibrous network of associations that goes with, you know, objects that have function and place and environmental significance and so on. And the fact that that's there in some proper nouns, but they're kind of at a lower level beneath the arbitrary sign. It strikes me that this is partly about deciding what something is not when we name things, rather than deciding what it is. Because so many things have, you know, objects, chair, table, carpet, you know, I'm just naming things in the room at the moment, cup. They have environmental associations and connections to each other, which could get confused and do get confused by people who are dementing at a slightly later stage. That is, words seem to reacquire a kind of universal application and everything becomes arbitrary. And it's very, very difficult for people to sort of alight on the right thing because the network that you've described could refer to anything. There are multiple points of entry, multiple points of exit in terms of meaning. What words are trying to do is establish what something is not. Because there are so many ways that things can be associated with each other. You're trying to find the one way it can't be, the one way even a common noun becomes proper in a sort of way, so that you know that that object is a plate or a dish. Does that make sense?
I mean, it has to be, because if you're naming something and we're then classifying it in this way, or fitting it in with the classification, that by definition you are excluding.
Yeah.
You're giving it a sort of function, a type, a category. That means it has to not be something else. And it seems to be, it's a very basic human tendency. We tend not to notice it because we simply find it's an absolute linguistic universal. It's a human universal. It doesn't matter if you're speaking in spoken language, if you're signing. What you do is you name things and you name each other. And we put these labels on things. And arguably, particularly in the visual domain. Your auditory world is much more filled up with sounds you won't necessarily recognise, but in the visual domain, we really want to give, we want to put labels on things.
Yeah.
And it's such a phenomenally overwhelming desire that it's hard. As I said, we don't notice that we do it, and we don't notice that, you know, how peculiar it is. Other animals perfectly able to get by without having to give names to things. Although a handful of other animals do seem to give names to each other, so maybe.
Yeah,
that's the starting point, maybe, is that.
I mean, the evolutionary argument that comes in right at the end, of course, is that there's a survival benefit in being able to say, look, you know, tiger coming. But there might also be an added benefit in being able to say, Mr. Vicious, the tiger is coming. In other words, the one that you know lives nearby that is particularly hungry all the time.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a very simple example of how a hierarchy can exist between proper names and common names.
It is very interesting if you look at the other animals who do seem to use names. They're highly social. So you get it in elephants and you get it in dolphins. And almost certainly, I know there's other examples out there, it is extremely uncommon. And basically people have found it by looking at the noises elephants make, for example, and how they change when they're around other individuals. Yeah. So it's, and for the elephants, you certainly get given that name. You don't turn up and tell the elephants your name. You get given it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an interesting...
Brian.
It's interesting if that's the entry level to naming, is to name each other.
Yeah.
And then, because of course we, you know, I mean, there are instances where people get to choose their names, but most of us, you're just stuck with what you're born with, and that's sort of, you don't think, I was thinking, well, the elephants just name each other. Well, no, we do that also. There aren't many things you can say are really odd and unusual about human cognition, but this kind of organisation of information into hierarchies and networks does seem to be really human. That maybe that's just naming then takes you off into naming anything, naming each other then takes you off into the possibility of this kind of how you can classify information in the world.
Well, you're trying to identify the particular object or person you mean, don't you? So what you find is that you can give someone a proper name like Brian, but of course there are many Brians. So there may, you know, there may have to be, there'll have to be a further degree of, you know, a repertoire of gesture, or know the other Brian or insistence in order to get to the particular one you mean. The naming function only goes so far. It can't, the sign can't really attach you to the referent, and that's what we're always struggling with.
Apparently, that is not the case in British Sign Language. So your name in British Sign Language will be something that speaks to your appearance.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Sometimes in a way that can be brutally honest. So it's, I'm not going to start getting into the details, but it can be really very honest, almost to a fault.
Well, that's what, I mean, and actually this is what comes into, this is the crux of the Mark Twain piece we've looked at. The word and the name is always absolutely sutured to the object.
Yeah.
The thing that, it's very funny, but the thing that Eve keeps saying is, Eve names everything because Adam's useless at it. I mean, I'd be really interested in the neuroscientist's view of that. So in these stories, it's a lovely idea. The diaries of you know, Adam and Eve, the first people in creation, coming to an awareness that they've just been born. And Eve's is a remarkably tender, lovely thing.
Yeah.
There's a lovely idea that she's much brighter than Adam. You know, she has all the kind of naming task, really. And she talks a lot and she thinks a lot. And he's not so interested. He's sort of constantly building sheds. It's very funny. But she just names things instantly, and she says, well, she knows it's a dodo. You know, it looks like a dodo. So there's always this sense that the word looks like the thing the object is. Actually, there isn't really a term for that, but there is a sort of term, because I looked it up, iconicity.
Yeah.
Where, rather as you described with sign language, the verbal gesture, whatever it is very, very essentially identified with the thing, and nothing can break that bond. So there isn't any gap, really, between sign and referent. They're very, very closely identified.
In Japanese, there's a whole class of words which effectively have very strong onomatopoeic elements for the speakers. But interestingly, not just for sort of...
But do they have visual onomatopoeia as well in the characters?
Visual, or certainly, but it, even in just what the words, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So there's a Japanese word, and I apologise to any Japanese speakers, nuru nuru, which means touching a slimy surface. And it has a very strong sensory association for people. So we do build that in. It's like an extreme example of that linking into the sensory characteristics of things.
That is really interesting, because it's all, if you think about it, it's true of quite a lot of English words. that attach to, that are tactile.
Yeah.
That have a tactile quality. Tacky is quite close to the sound of a viscous substance clinging and then snapping back. Yeah. Tacky, it's...
Slime.
Yeah.
Has that kind of something sliding along fine. So it's definitely there. It's definitely there. We are not... This collection of words that we're using for naming things is not abstract, even in their surface characteristics. Absolutely. I love that you link that in with the Adam and Eve piece. I mean, it's sometimes extremely literal. I think the word for cat in Chinese, Mandarin, it's either Mandarin or Cantonese, it's meow meow. You know, and that sort of linking again is not unusual. In fact, there's an argument that says, because all around the world, the words for mother, father, and grandma or granddad, you keep finding the same words coming up again, like dada, mama, baba. Yeah. And that's because those are the sounds babies make.
Yeah.
And we go, oh, she means me. that's why mama, dada are basically, they go together because of where they're made in the mouth, and the parents hear them and link them, and that's why you find this enormous commonality, because it's just, that's what babies do.
That is very interesting. Is that slightly different there? Because that's about attribution.
Oh, totally, totally. It's just another way of getting to the commonality from where it comes from. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
What's interesting about what Eve is doing is that she is, as far as we can tell from the piece, she's not acting on a cue particularly. No. She's doing something rather pure, and that's why it's comic.
Yeah.
Because she just... says
it just is.
It is a tiger. There's a sort of problem beneath all this, isn't there, about the question of what lies underneath a word and what we use mentally to recognize the word as a word that refers to this object, seems to me to go back and back and back and back. This paper doesn't address is how you know a name is a name.
Yeah.
It talks about the loss of the ability to retrieve the names, but it doesn't give us very much about how we know that this concept of naming, how the concept refers to the object, which seems to be a more fundamental level. But as soon as you say that, you realise that there's probably a layer beneath that, which is how you know what a concept is, how you know what an object is. And this is what, you know, people like Leibniz were very interested in, and I am to a less, you know, less easily explained way, because I don't know enough about it. But I don't know where do you start that process and where do you stop it?
One thing that you seem to find from a brain perspective is that there are two things going on. So you get information coming in, and this is primarily, you know, hearing words or reading them, or you might be, you know, reading Braille and coming through your fingertips. And what you first see in the brain is perceptual processing associated with that. So reading words looks different initially because it's coming into visual areas than hearing words. Even true for the Braille reading, that information all sort of flows forward down the temporal lobes, such that by the time you're at the front end of the temporal lobes, so these are, if you think of the brain as looking a bit like a boxing glove, this is the thumb of the boxing glove, it becomes less and less tied, the representations that you're dealing with seem less and less tied to the sensory input and become more and more amodally associated with semantic information. So by the time you're at the front end of the temporal lobes, you'll get a response to a word, and it doesn't actually matter if you read it or you heard it. So you've got this sort of incoming flow of sensory information, and you also have a kind of continual process that seems to be going on when you are listening to speech or when you're reading, where the frequency with which words are associated with each other drives a kind of anticipatory response. So if I listen to a sentence like, the ship sailed across the bay, by the time the word bay is, and all other words associated with sea and seafaring starts to get activated, and they're going, could it be me? Could it be me? And that means that it's easier to understand a sentence like, the ship sailed across the bay, than a sentence like Sue discussed the bruise, where you've got nothing to help you unless you know something about Sue and her disgusting interest in bruises. So you're just seeing the sort of bottom-up processing going on. But in reality, there's normally huge amounts of kind of feedback stuff trying to anticipate what's coming in.
Yeah, I think that's partly what John Searle calls the background information. Everything takes place against a background of, you know, of this connotation as opposed to denotation, associative fibres that attach to other things.
It almost makes me think about the human brain in some ways that you look at it. It's like a machine for pulling out that meaning that you're talking about, what it wants at a very fundamental level. And this is not the whole brain, but a big part of the brain wants to understand what's going on. It wants to be able to label it. It wants to be able to classify it. That might be naming it, or it might be kind of processing a whole episode. I was reading a really interesting paper by Avital Hahame, who's, maybe we should look at this at some point, where she was looking at how you process information. We experience life not as a continuous flow, we experience it as episodes. And she's finding the same kind of classification and chunking is going on at the level of experiencing episodes, say in a film, as is happening for pulling out the single words. You know, so it's involving a bigger system of brain regions, but it's incorporating memory as well as meaning. But you can sort of see all of that as the brain. We're always just trying to make sense. We're unhappy if we can't make sense.
It's quite interesting that the sense we're talking about is, yeah, it's trying to pull things out of a kind of, as you say, sort of swirling context, which I think links to my earlier point about, you know, about indivisibility of concepts, that you're trying to get at what is essentially true, if you like, about this word that makes it refer to the object. What's interesting about the way you've described it is very, very clear and very practical, and it describes a really something we all experience in getting older, that being able to pull words out of a mix of possibilities gets harder in certain situations, and we seek other cues to make the retrieval more possible. You know, the name goes, but you have the semantic information, you just need another route to it. And that suggests that the name sits on top of a multiply divided series of layers of association. So you can get there, you just have to find another route through the pyramid. Philosophers, and I'm not a philosopher, but this is the interesting thing, is that they're very interested in something called substance. For a philosopher, a substance is not the stuff that we think a substance is. It is the essential, individual, undivided, fundamental thing of which the world is made up. For Plato, it was forms. He thought that was the sort of the essential thing. In Leibniz always mentioned, thought it was monads. Democritus thought it was atoms. What some philosophers don't necessarily distinguish so well between is actually the physical and the mental worlds. It's interesting that for them, their essential thing, whatever it is, partakes of both realms, it seems to me. You know, the an essential being for Leibniz can be a person, or it can be, I might have this massively wrong, but it can be a person, or it can be something like the Eiffel Tower. They tend to, quite a few philosophers wed the conceptual and the physical. I wonder if they're always aware that they're doing it. How does that affect what the brain does with the abstract and the physical? What's the difference between being able to remember a proper name that attaches to a person and, for example, a common name that describes a concept like pain?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So when I was first involved in taking photographs of brain imaging, you know, what the brain in action, this was something that we looked at quite a lot because we knew it was there. We know it's easier for patients with brain damage to remember high imageable words than low imageable words, and low imageable words are abstract words, and abstract words are the concepts you describe. We were doing these studies that would show, like, you get lots of visual brain area activated when you hear a word like glove, which is very imageable, and you don't get that high, that visibility, sort of visual area of the brain activated if you hear a word like government or love or pain. And what you seemed to get was more auditory cortex activation. So maybe you have to just use the sound of the word to help you get to the meaning of the abstract word. And over a few years, there were a number of these studies, and people kept finding the same thing. You could find a sort of strong sensory association for words that have high visual imageability or auditory imageability, and sort of just a lack of that for the abstract words, the concept words, as you say. And then my colleague Gabriella Villiocco at UCL, she went in and asked a different question. Instead of looking for sensory qualities of words, she asked about their emotional qualities. And what you find is that people find abstract words to have very strong emotional connotations, mm. more so than the kind of high imageable words like glove. So it's obvious with a word like love, but government, you know, there's an emotional valence to that, and it might vary across people, but it's there. And so it seems that we still kind of, if you like, people use the term embodying for this using of the sensory characteristics of words to help you kind of embed them, or the physical characteristics, you know, to help you think about verbs. You sort of think about verbs that involve movements of the body. You seem to actually use a body map to encode those. But it looks like we're still embodying the conceptual words. It's just we're embodying them in a more...
Well, that's really interesting. That's a lovely thing that happens in Eve's diary. I don't know if you remember her first sorrow. Yes. The paradox of the story, what makes it so funny is, of course, that she's perfectly articulate. She has all these words because she's writing a diary. And yet she's talking about her first encounter with certain words.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of enfoldedness, which is very, very funny and lovely.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of words that she already has, but she just doesn't know that she has them. And they're often the abstract material of grammar, things like I, we, he, they.
Yes.
You know, and also abstract concepts that are embodied by something that happens to her. So she never alights on the word sorrow. She doesn't name sorrow, but it comes to her as exactly this, a sort of bodily feeling.
Yeah.
Because Adam doesn't let her in the shed at night and it's raining. And so she's stuck out in the rain. And she says, it was my first sorrow. The word is just there.
Yeah.
It just arrives. And it's the first time we've heard the word. And this is why he's such a good writer. He veers between the out-and-out comic, the stuff about the tigers and dodos and just sort of naming things, but also the extremely subtle.
Yeah.
The idea that all these kind of registers of feeling are innate in her. And not only are they innate, but that she is a poet to the extent that she knows the word for these feelings.
Yeah.
And the word is in her, yeah. And it's a part of her physical and, you know, emotional physical apparatus.
I was really struck by it, actually. It's not something I'd read before, this kind of reimagining of this extremely overfamiliar story, but really kind of building a humanity into it that was, it was genuinely moving.
It's very moving towards the end because it's a love story.
Yeah.
They don't understand each other to begin with, and they can't operate in the world they've been created for.
Yeah.
So Eve keeps trying to grab the stars.
Yes.
And then knock them out of the sky to clods of earth.
Yeah.
Adam doesn't understand what crying is.
Yeah.
So he just sees water coming out of her eyes and doesn't know that, yeah, they're tears.
Yeah.
And yet they have other apparently sophisticated ways of relating to themselves marked out by the diary. I actually think he's saying something quite profound there, which is that behind the acquired apparatus of self, which is partly linguistic, it's partly sensory, proprioceptive, behind all that there is, if you like, the original monitoring consciousness that comes before language and any other of those functions.
Mm.
I mean, the first time I can remember being aware of it is, it's the silent person you look at in the mirror. And there's no content to the stare. There's no, you're not thinking anything about yourself. You are aware, but there's no aboutness. There's the original gaze, that is the original sentience, if you like. And I think that what Twain is getting at is just that original sentience,
mm,
that marks out the human characteristic. Before you name, before you speak, before you know who you are in, yeah, relation to other people, there is a sort of untethered person that is absolutely you, but could also be an aspect of something more universal, so universal consciousness. And he really nails that,
mm,
in this story, that people are, they're slowly separating themselves from that universal idea and becoming individuals. But right at the start, there's just the first opening of the eye, knowing that you are you,
yeah,
not being able to explain it, not yet being able to reach other people, but knowing it absolutely. It's both a fact of cognition, but it is also a feeling.
Mm.
It's driven by a feeling that you are you.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you've had this experience in dealing with, you know, your relatives, but when my mother had dementia, I think one of the most powerful things for me was looking at her looking back at me. And I felt very strongly, I wasn't going to make up any stories about it. I knew that she didn't know who I was anymore, but I did know that she was still a sentient creature.
Mm.
Because the look that came out of her eyes was that pre-verbal knowingness that you are alive and that you're a creature in the world.
Yeah.
And that is a sort of powerful thing. And I think that so much of the ways in which, you know, name retrieval and dementia is talked about, it misses the point. It's quite egotistical. We're constantly worried about whoever the person is not knowing who we are. That's not the issue. The issue is, does the person who's got the dementia know who they are inside? I mean, inside is already a metaphor. You know, and in a way, I want to get away from the interiority thing. What is the point at which we know any kind of knowingness of being alive has gone?
Every single case of where somebody apparently seems to not know who they are anymore, it quite often makes the newspapers. The man's been found on a beach and he can play the piano, but he doesn't know who he is. They're always psychogenic. It seems to be, you know, it, as far as we can determine, like a sense of self, you being you. You know, I'm going to use different language, but it's, you know, getting exactly your point, something incredibly central to being awake at all, almost.
Yeah.
So Clive Waring, he was a very talented musician and worked for the BBC, and he got herpes simplex encephalitis affecting his brain. And it's a horrible, horrible disease. It just destroys brain tissue. When you have a stroke, there's a possibility of the brain areas that are affected by the stroke. Some of them will recover. This will not happen with herpes simplex encephalitis. It's horrid. So it just took out great quantities of his temporal lobes, including his hippocampi bilaterally. And it's left him. He's still alive. He's lived like this for sort of 40 years now. Densely amnestic, such that he cannot access any of his old memories consciously. And he cannot form any new ones. He can learn procedural things like where cups go in a cupboard, but it's not. He can't learn people's names or learn what's happening to him. And he's conscious. He's so amnestic. He has such a complete loss of his memory. His waking experience is of continuously waking up. I've just come out from a coma. I've just come out from a coma. All other people with amnesia, you can give them diaries and they can write things down in their diary to help them. If he writes in his diary, he'll then go straight back and cross it out and say, someone's been writing in my diary. But he still knows who he is. He knows two other things. If you play music, or he gets to conduct music, he is in the music. That's that the music, like, scaffolds him and holds him there so that he doesn't feel like he's waking up all the time. He can engage with the music. And when he sees his wife, he knows who his wife is.
Yeah.
He doesn't understand why she's been away for so long, but she's back. And that's it. So it's sense of self, music, and wife are the things that he's left
it's
with.
It's fascinating, that, isn't it? That really is fascinating. I mean, that sort of bears out what we've been saying, that I think there is some fundamental ground, which is, as you say, it's very, very close to the light coming on for the first time, whatever that is, in a child or waking up. It seems to be a... And interestingly, of course, the... You know, a lot of early modern poetry and a lot of poetry full stop. The comparison between the life is often, you know, a day. It's, you know, the morning.
Yeah.
The morning is youth. Is it the shining morning face, the speech and as you like it? And so morning is associated with youth, and the end of the day is associated with senescence and death. But there's something to that, actually. It's not just an idle metaphor.
Mm.
Because it turns out that the experience of being is like waking up, and the experience of not being is like a slide towards death. And it's not just like, it actually seems to be an extended, maybe consciousness is an extended diurnal thing of which we are just an aspect.
Charles Fernyhough, he's a psychologist based in Durham, but he's also a writer, and he argues that actually to understand consciousness, you can't just use science. You need to look at things like not how people describe awareness and experience in writing. And he pointed out that people's early memories are often very, very, involve very strong sunlight. And that seems to be because your early memories are there before your verbal, and they are pretty much sensory because you haven't got words for things. And sunlight and being in sunlight is of, that's when there's going to be more sensory information around you. That's certainly my earliest memory is of, on brand, is some carpeting in extremely bright sunlight, presumably because I was on the floor. And it's, of course, that's something that you, it turns up a lot. He gives examples of different writers who've written about this. I am stupid enough not to know any of them. But it's, his insight is coming from the writing and people's memories. And exactly as you say, that's...
Well, the relationship between light and knowledge, you know, Hail, Holy, Logos, the whole, you know, the whole creation myth is about illumination is creation.
It's even like your start, your foundational memories of being conscious are of brightness.
It's a very powerful idea, isn't it? It suggests that there's something not simply mythic, but real about that metaphor and about the biblical story, that it is, you know, you're, well, it's true also in the sense that, you know, we all come from the sun. Not wishing to open the kind of gates too much to cosmology, but it is the case that, you know, without the sun there isn't anything. That's always the thing I've found. I remember it being like a kind of a moment of incredible illumination and brightness when I realised that everything we see around us is forged inside a star. All the heavier, you know, everything. Comes from a nuclear explosion. Fusion to begin with, and then explosions. I'm going to say a tiny bit more about Adam and Eve.
Please do, because I keep going back to brains.
No, I love brains. And he, there's one way in which you can read this story, and you can see it as being, you know, of its time and quite sort of maritally sexist in the sense that, you know, she puts up with all sorts of nonsense, and you know you can find yourself flinching a little bit at some of the ends of it. But it's also the clever thing about Twain is it's leavened with such a degree of emotional realism too. Mm. You don't ever doubt that these two people are slowly falling in love and that they miss each other when they're not there. But as I said at the start, the great twist, Eve is the sort of brains behind the whole operation. And
the scientist, she keeps going out and sort of testing theories.
Yes, she refers to herself as an experiment.
Yeah.
And Adam as another experiment. But there's a lovely passage I just wanted to read.
Oh, please.
In which she's encountered Adam and she's drawn to him, but she can't really work out. Oh, there's the lovely thing about the children, which we'll have to come back to. But this is what she says about Adam. Adam, who is never named, interestingly. He doesn't gain a name at all. And in the Bible, Eve, this is slightly different to biblical chronology is a bit odd, because in the Bible, Eve is not named until after the fall.
Mm.
So we don't actually know what her proper name is until after the fall.
Yeah.
Whereas we know Adam earlier. But anyway, this is Twain. And this is Eve talking about Adam. I think it is a man. I had never seen a man, but it looked like one, and I feel sure that that is what it is. I realise that I feel more curiosity about it than about any of the other reptiles, if it is a reptile, and I suppose it is, for it has frowsy hair and blue eyes and looks like a reptile. It has no hips, it tapers like a carrot when it stands, it spreads itself apart like a derrick. So I think it is a reptile, though it may be architecture. And he's very, very good at random significance, because, of course, what she's deciding doesn't look much like a reptile at all. But it doesn't seem to matter to her.
No, it's beautiful. It's not, as I said, just not what I was expecting at all.
He divides the whole story into days, rather like creation days, and then the days go out the window. This is a clever way in which he captures something of the oddity of the creation story itself, and indeed of the whole first five books of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, which is that time is elastic. First of all, you begin with days, and then quite quickly you're on to generations, and the years and eons are sort of moving away from you at great pace. And he does something a bit similar here, We have days to begin with, and then there are leaps in time. Adam, in fact, it's Adam's diary, where the arrival of the children is very funny. He thinks that Eve has caught them. Yes. Presumably he's not noticed her being pregnant. That's very, very good. The children turn up, and to begin with, he's completely baffled. He thinks it's a fish. Yeah. Then he thinks it's a kangaroo.
Yes.
And it grows. And then it begins to talk, and he realises, 10 years later, he realised, they are boys. You know, it was the fact that they were so small to begin with that sort of confused us. Again, interesting the idea that he had the knowledge. This is a bit like the retrieval thing, the pathway. He had the knowledge that they were boys all along, but he couldn't retrieve it.
Mm.
It's like a kind of reverse dementia, that, you know the aptness of something to be called a thing, but you can't quite grasp it as an early age, because you're still learning how to do that. Although that was very nice.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. It was lovely.
And then the time it grows again, and we leap to their expulsion from the garden. And what's very good about that is he doesn't lean on the biblical story very much at all. And I love the fact that there's no blame attached. That really, on balance, Adam clearly thinks he's much better off being with her than not. And that he sees the wealth of knowledge that she's given him as being a huge benefit to him. And emotionally, intellectually, practically, he sees her rationless self that's brought about the apparent disaster as being absolutely essential to him and who he is. That's very touching. It's quite an important anti-fundamentalist position that Twain is taking. He's saying that investigation and scepticism and doubt and renaming and, examining things and working out what they are is actually much more important than an obsession with fundamental mistakes.
Yeah.
Original sin.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. Or getting something wrong. The little bit I read out, she actually gets quite a lot wrong in her own terms. You know, he's not a reptile. She doesn't even think he looks like a reptile, really. It doesn't matter if she gets it wrong. What matters is the person she identifies. And similarly, what matters to these two people is the life they build for themselves.
The other thing that's really different about the sort of words for things in the world and words for people is the social element of, I mean, getting words wrong, you want to get words right. That's generally the case. But actually, the people aren't sort of just another kind of object. There are conspecifics, they're the important things in our networks.
Yeah.
And so the horror of getting somebody's name wrong, but also just the fundamental importance of the knowing that person and having that name there, the sort of the significance of knowing their name. Once you know someone's name, you have some kind of connection to them. They know yours. It's, unless they're famous, okay, different class, but generally in our evolution, the people you knew the names of were the people that you know.
Yeah.
And there's tremendous meaning built up in that, and sort of that's the size and the scale and the strength of your social network predicts your physical, your mental health, even how long you'll live. You know, so it's not that network of names for people is not a neutral thing.
No, but there are limits to that too, aren't there? I mean, you can't. It's interesting. We met last week at a gig that I was doing at the Wigmore Hall, and afterwards, I was at the desk and sort of signing a few books, and I was actually quite pleased insofar as I remembered most of the people who came up to me. So I knew a lot of them. And then I missed two names. And it wasn't that I mean, of course, this is what people say who forget names. It's not that I don't know them. It's just that I had a senior moment. But the context there is quite interesting because I'd already remembered a lot of other names.
Yeah.
And I was tired.
Yeah.
And I felt I didn't have the mental energy, the resources. I mean, that's something we've not said something about, the impacts of fatigue
distress
on being able to retrieve names.
So, I mean, as they say in the paper, as he says in the paper, no matter how you slice it, it is always harder to name people than name things, remember the names of people than the names of things, because of these different factors. And that means that it's simply more vulnerable. It's going to be vulnerable to brain damage. It's going to be vulnerable to other things that affect your cognition. And tiredness is a big one. And when having spent a long, you did a talk, and that can't have been a simple thing to prepare. And then that's a lot of work meeting all those people again and signing all those names and remembering all those names. So that's you're allowed to be fatigued by the end of that.
Well, you've made me feel a lot better about that, because, of course, being who I am, I was absolutely terrified. I thought, oh, it's happening. It's happening.
It's here, of all places.
You know, I can't remember who James is. Well, one of the names that I couldn't remember is this guy called James Hark, who's a very, very good singer. His actual name is James Duckworth. So he doesn't make it easier for me, because he's given himself half a stage name, but not a complete change.
Yes, let me start all over again and we'll see how we get on.
So I think I was slightly wrestling with that. Plus he'd had a haircut that made him look like Russell Tovey. So I was thinking, is it Russell Tovey? Not James. Anyway, it's too confusing.
One of the things that's always impressed me by my family is they're quite prone to, like, just not having the, simply not using the name that they were given as children. So my father found out when he received papers to go and do his national service that his name was actually John. And as far as he was aware, he'd always been called Colin. And his sister was laughing at him. And then it turned out, in fact, her name, which she thought was Carol, was Gillian. My grandmother was very into changing everybody's names.
Well, that's the problem, of course, with designating. That's another kind of argument about arbitrary reference, isn't it? That you're given a name. And then, rather like Eve, you end up looking and sounding and being rather like some other sort of proper name. So you might be, you know, John to begin with, but actually you're a Colin.
The absolute 10 out of 10, no notes, high-class, bitchiest thing anybody's ever said to me to my face was that the name Sophie didn't suit me, as it's too pretty.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
And I thought, what would you think? Maybe Boot or Wellington? I don't know, where are we going with this?
That is extraordinary. That is extraordinary.
It was just, even at the time, I was impressed. That was, oh,
I hope that person, who was that person? That person sounds like a real Marjorie to me.
I'm not going there. I'm going to take the high road. But tell us a little bit more about your event last week, because the Neuromantics have a new book out, by which I mean Will has a new book out.
Very, very quickly. It's about music and composition. It's called The Point of Distraction. I've got a sideline, kind of, in writing music, but I hadn't done any for a very, very long time, for about 30 years. I came back to it in lockdown, and it's just a very short memoir about my experience of doing something that's supposed to be kind of, you know, in the wings over there, not what I do for a living, a hobby. What happens when those things become a bit more central to your life again? Which is a subject we've touched on in the Neuromantics.
Yeah, I really recommend it. It's a beautiful book. I haven't finished it, but it's also got links to all the musical pieces that Will's written, which are performed by
Richard Utley,
and it's really beautiful, and it's a very novel way of kind of engaging with the book and the music, so I definitely recommend it.
Thank you very much, Sophie, and thank you all for listening, and we will be back, we hope, sooner rather than later.
It'll be soon, guys. It'll be soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.